Aboriginal woman Kerry Salter is on a stolen Harley Davidson, roaring back into her hometown on the New South Wales north coast. She's there to farewell her dying pop and has no plans to stay in the tiny town where she grew up dirt poor and bullied by the white kids at her school. But the Bundjalung country seems to have a pull on her, and she finds it increasingly hard to leave. After all, her complicated family needs her, there are plans to develop a prison on the family's beloved river, and there's a handsome white man who's proving to be pretty distracting. Too Much Lip is the latest novel by the award-winning writer Melissa Lukashenko. So, has Melissa ever been accused of having too much lip?
The short answer is yes, and it would take too long to explain.
Yeah, but sometimes hard to keep your opinions to yourself.
Well, I'm often I often discover that I'm confronting even when I'm trying not to be. So, you know, maybe it's a case of being black while breathing and being feminist while alive.
Absolutely. Look, Kerry is a fantastic protagonist, but she's really fascinating because right from the start, we know she's on a stolen motorbike, she's done jail time, she's breaching her parole, but she has so much spunk, and from page one I was totally rooting for her. What made you want to write a complicated hero like this?
Well, at some time in the last 3 or 4 years, I came across this idea that the job of an artist is to look around and ask what's going on, and I look around and I know a few women like Kerry Salter. She's an amalgam of a few sisters of mine, mostly black but some white. And, you know, I work with criminalised women on a weekly basis as well with Sisters Inside. And I wanted to capture some of that humour and just the energy and, as you say, the spunk. Because everything's heightened in the Aboriginal underclass and in jail. You know, not only the pain is heightened and the grief of being poor and black and oppressed, but the humour is heightened, the love is heightened, the wit is heightened. And I kind of wanted to write an antidote to the depressive gloom that we sort of seem to be sliding into as, you know, the right wing gains momentum around the world. It was like, no, depression is not the answer, people. The answer is, and the answer isn't outrage either, because outrage is a substitute for action. The answer is to be angry about the right things at the right time. And that's where Kerry Salter came from.
Is that a hard thing to do, to write something which is optimistic and hopeful in a time where you are angry and frustrated about the world?
It's a lot easier than the alternative, which is to give up, which is why the second part of the book is called If You Don't Fight, You Lose. You know, if there's a message in the book, that's it. If you don't fight, you lose. And superficially, it looks like it's a book about an adventure in the criminal underclass, and it is that. And I wanted it to be fun and funny, and people tell me it is funny. And then if you dig down another layer, it's about intergenerational trauma in an Aboriginal family across 3 generations or 4 generations. Mm. But if you dig below that again, it's actually a book about class. And I said to the Sydney Morning Herald 2 years ago when I was just beginning the process of writing it, of putting hand to laptop, that I wanted to look at the intersection of race and class in the very poor areas of Australia. And this is before Trump got elected, before Trump was nominated. It wasn't an easy book to write by any means, but it's a hell of a lot easier to write about than to just sink into the despair that suits the powers that be.
Yeah. Kerry's family live in this dilapidated house in this fictional town, which has the brilliant name of Dorongo. They're relying on welfare. They don't even know if they're going to be able to pay for Pop's funeral. This is really crippling poverty that they're living in. How do you identify with this, Melissa?
I don't pretend to be other than middle class now, but 2 years ago, just before I got a Cal grant to write the book, I was driving Uber. And there's, you know, members of my family, including siblings of mine, are very poor. You know, one of my siblings lives a transient life in Logan, for a number of reasons. He's not technically homeless, but he's certainly transient and on the street a lot. And in my extended family, there's people who can't afford their cancer medication. You know, there's people who know a lot about pushing cars rather than driving cars, let's say.
Mm. There's a line in the book, and there's a language warning for this line, but it says, "It was a shame job to go explaining how blackfellas lived. Even if you guys believed you, they were full of useless fucking genius suggestions on how to climb out of poverty, like it was simple." Is this a message that you hear, Melissa, or your family has heard?
Oh, I think anyone who's poor in the Western world has heard, you know, genius ideas about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and thinking positive. It's, you know, you've got to laugh or you'd just, you know, you'd start chopping heads off, I'm sure. And I suppose my book falls somewhere between the two, between just laughing or getting out the tumbrils. On the other hand, it's like, yeah, let's have a good old laugh at the way things are, but let's also get angry about it and start thinking about taking some collective action about it.
Melissa, your story, as well as being about this family, is about country. And I was hoping you might be able to set the scene by doing a short reading from the book. This is a moment where Kerry, our hero, is swimming in the river, and this is a place of special significance to her family. And there is another small language warning in this reading.
Mm. Yeah, the book, as much as anything, is a homage to my great-grandmother. And there's a lot of, it's a semi-autobiographical book. This particular story isn't from my immediate family, but here goes. The bend on the river was the most sacred place the Salters knew. Right there, Kerry thought, where the shadow of the hoop pine is blackening the water and the sand. That's where Granny Ava swam to save two lives and made it, and now here we all are. If there had been no hoop pine root there to pull herself out of the river by, had the resident bull sharks been less agreeable that day, had the horses of the white men been more willing to enter the cold August water, any of these, and there would be no Kerry floating in the sun, gazing down at the silver flashes of school mullet beneath her. No Granny Ruth, no Pretty Mary, no Ken, no Black Superman, no nobody. There's a pretty simple lesson there, then. When the men with guns come after you, you go and you go fucking hard and you don't look back. Kerry remembered the moment she first heard her great-grandmother's legend. 9 years old, in the corner of the front veranda, forgotten, with her head in a comic book. Auntie Tall Mary had been talking about the Yugambeh massacres further north, how the mob feasted by invitation on poisoned flour at Mudgeribah, and how these days butter wouldn't melt in the white descendants' mouths. "They shot Granny Ava," Pretty Mary had cried out bitterly. "Used their muskets on her and made the river run red. Ah, oh, but she kept going. She was a strong old girl, that one, true's God, and lucky too. Her dad knew, see? Old King Bobby, he looked after her. Sung that necklace they give him and made it a weapon. Take more and muskets to stop that clever old fella. Granny climbed out alive on the island with his song around her neck. Picked up a big rock and chucked it over the water, telling them dugeyes to go to buggery. Stood there bleeding onto her own dirt, swearing 'em proper, trying to make 'em swim across to her. She always said that if she was going to finish up, she'd finish up on her own country, facing the dugeyes square on. She wanted 'em to see her face at the end, see? But they give up before she did, scared of a bit of cold river water, and lucky for them they was. Lucky for us too, maybe."
Australian author Melissa Lukashenko reading from her novel Too Much Lip. Melissa, this sacred place where Kerry is swimming, this bend in the river, is under threat. How is it under threat?
It's under threat because it's been stolen more than once, and the most recent stealing of it is by the corrupt mayor of the local shire, Jim Buckley, whose family have been entwined with the Salter family for generations now. And Jim wants to develop it, or Jim wants to sell it to a Chinese consortium who will develop it with the state government as a jail. And, you know, as in many other aspects of the book, as I was writing it, I discovered that it was coming true to life. You know, there is a very large jail proposed on Bundjalung land, which the local community are not too happy about, which I didn't know when I plotted the book out. You know, things like this happened a lot with this book. It often happens with writers, but I had no idea I was writing such a semi-autobiographical book as I was.
And I'm so glad you read for us, Melissa, because I just loved the use of language in this book and the way you weave, they're Bundjalung words that you've weaved into the text there.
Yeah, it's the Yugambeh language, which is the northernmost part of the Yugambeh Bundjalung language chain, which stretches from the Logan River in the north down to Grafton in the south.
And we heard that word dugai a few times there, and it comes up a lot in the book. What is a dugai?
A dugai is a ghost, and as in lots of Aboriginal languages, when white fellas first turned up, they were assumed to be ghosts, and so the word for ghost became the word for white fella. So dugai, migaloo, same word.
And as a dugai myself, I guess, reading this book, I really enjoyed the way you incorporated this language into the book, even if sometimes it would take me a while, I'd have to read for a while to kind of pick up what the words meant. Are you trying to challenge that the reader in your writing?
Yeah, again, it's tricky because this is these are words that are in my everyday consciousness, so I sometimes forget when I'm reading that the readers aren't. I always try and make it clear from the context what I'm talking about. And I learnt from Uncle Bruce Pascoe in his wonderful book Earth how to educate the reader as you go along, I suppose. So if you're struggling at page 10, I hope that you're well on the way to understanding a few words of Yugambeh by page 20.
Yeah, but, you know, I was. It was fun for me.
It's not a bad thing to. Well, it's not a bad thing to understand that you don't speak Australian languages either. But I do always try and make it clear from the context.
What response do you get to the use of that language? Does anyone ever say use less Aboriginal language?
No one's ever said that. I've had lots of people say that it was great to see, and then in some of my books I've had a glossary at the end, and I chose not to do that this time because there's actually a lot less Aboriginal language in this book than in my last book. In Mullumbimby, that was a book absolutely infused with country and with culture. And in some ways what I'm writing here is a family from the Aboriginal underclass, which is very clearly Aboriginal, but not in the same way that Joe in Mullumbimby is Aboriginal. Their Aboriginality comes out in other ways other than the pursuit of language, for instance. It's just there. There's a bit of it just there in their lives, and they don't think about it much.
Melissa, it feels like a pretty wonderful time for Indigenous writing. We've had Alexis Wright win the Stella Prize, Kim Scott's in the running once again for the Miles Franklin. We've seen a lot of new Indigenous voices enter the publishing world. How do you reflect on the state of Indigenous literature right now?
Yeah, I think it's going gangbusters, really. And, you know, I've got to pay tribute to people like Sue Abbey, who back at UQ Press in the, well, the 80s, not even the 90s, back in the 80s, was agitating for the David Unaipin Award to be created as a, you know, Sue Abbey and a very few other people at that time knew that Aboriginal writing was going to be very, very big in Australian writing and writing in the English canon way back then. And it's taken until now, it's taken, you know, 30 years before the rest of the Australian publishing industry has actually caught up and gone, oh, we'll institute this award and we'll institute that award and we'll actually start to see First Nations writing for what it is, which is the bedrock stories of this country, you know, the foundational stories of the Australian nation will be found in First Nations writing. We're not living in the time of Lawson and Patterson anymore. We're living in the time of Kim Scott and Larissa Berent and Alexis Wright and Bruce Pascoe and Ellen Van Nieuwen.
And I think it's safe to say we're living in the time of Melissa Lukashenko too. Too Much Lip is published by the University of Queensland Press, and I really liked it.